Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I don't know about you, but one of the most common questions I get is, how do I go about preparing for these podcasts with you? How do I get myself ready to, you know, mentally and verbally spar with an intellect such as yourself? And the most common answer I give is that, you know, my life is basically preparation. You know, just, you know, going about my daily business is just one constant preparation for these conversations. But I will say this, I have some unconventional training techniques as well, okay? I try to push my mind and body to the limits so that I can always bring the heat against you. So, for example, in the last week, I went to Death Valley and I stared straight into 124 degree wind over some sand dunes that really looked like they were straight out of Saudi Arabia. Then the next day I went climbing inside a volcanic cone, straight up essentially the side of a mountain through, you know, black lava type gravel to get up there. It really put me at one with nature. And then to top it all off, Andrew, I went deep into the forest. I went to the home turf of the California black bear, and what do you know? I saw a black bear. I stared into its eyes. I looked into its soul. I did not blink, and after that experience, you can throw whatever you want at me. I'm ready to go.
That's right. You're replenished. You got your Ranger Rick time after doing your tour of duty in Las Vegas. I appreciated that as I was trying to schedule this podcast, you sent back, like, a rough itinerary and then just a picture of a black bear. And I liked it because I know that that's where you're at peace. So you got to do your thing this weekend. And you, by the way, you left out the highlight of the trip, the Sacramento Railroad Museum, which you were also hitting me off with highlights from. So it was a great little 5 days for you.
Well, I'll be honest, too. I mean, I sent you that black bear as intimidation. I wanted you to know that I'm ready. So bring it on. Let's
Mamba
get to the questions.
Mentality.
Exactly. We got some great questions from the openfloormail@gmail.com listeners. You know what I love, Andrew, is that even though we are slowing down here to one episode per week, the emails have not slowed down at all. I mean, people are sending in great questions, forward-thinking, big-picture type questions, free agency reaction. They really covered the gamut, and I think we're ready to dive in.
It's great. And this is one that I saved. We were going to do it last week, but then real news happened, and we kind of hit that. But I like this from Thaddeus, who says, going back a few podcasts, I thought Sharp's thoughts on Jason Tatum's ceiling were interesting. I agree. I think he might be destined to fulfill his 12-time All-Star open floor destiny, but also he may never be a top 10 player. Essentially, he'd be settling into the tier of Jimmy Butler, Paul George, Gordon Hayward, Klay Thompson, John Wall, Dame Lillard type guys. Really good players, but on the fringes of the top 10. So, on that note, who do you guys think will be a top 10 player in 5 years? At that point, Anthony Davis will be 30 years old, Giannis will be 28, and the rest of the current top 10 will be in their mid to late 30s. So, Ben, you talk about preparation. This is one where we did have to do a little bit of homework and come up with some lists. What do you have for this question?
Well, first of all, I've been doing the top 100 list for so long with SI, I could actually go back 5 years as a reference point. So I thought this was pretty interesting. Here was our top 10 from 5 years ago, okay? LeBron 1, KD 2, Chris Paul 3, Tony Parker 4. Look, he was coming off an MVP caliber season, but yes, we overrated Tony Parker.
I still cannot believe you guys did that. I honestly, that's the most shocking top 100 ranking of the last like 10 years.
5, Westbrook. 6, Tim Duncan. 7, Dwight. 8, Dwayne Wade. 9, Kobe Bryant. 10, Melo. So I think the lesson from that list is that a lot of the guys who are sort of regarded as top 10 talents right now are going to be in retirement, you know, in, you know, partial retirement by playing for the Charlotte Hornets like Tony Parker, or at a completely different stage of their career, a la Melo or Dwayne Wade, where they're not really in the conversation. So I think when you're looking to try to build the top 10 list for 5 years from now, you have to be really careful with which of the current guys you expect to still be in there. And the guys that I came up with, and tell me what you think, I think KD will still be in that group. Now, he has said he might want to retire in 5 years. That was kind of a loose lips KD moment there after the finals. So assuming he doesn't retire, I think KD can still be in there. He's only 29. I think Harden has a pretty good chance to be in there. He's 28. And then I think a guy like Kyrie, health permitting, could still be in that conversation. You know, past that, guys like Steph Curry, obviously LeBron is going to be too old at that point. Chris Paul is going to be too old. I don't see Westbrook aging very well. I mean, that's sort of my list of the current stars who are still going to be in this conversation. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the way I broke it down is I set up a couple different categories. On the one hand, the only real locks that I see to be in the top 100 or the top 10 in 5 years are Giannis and Anthony Davis, because I think, you know, Giannis will be 27 years old at that point, or 28 years old. Anthony Davis will be 30, and they're so good that a tragic injury would have to befall one of them for them not to be in there. And then
you're wrong already. I mean, come on. Why are you slighting Ben Simmons? Come on, put him in that category. He's going to be right there with Giannis and Anthony Davis.
Here's the thing, okay? I had four categories. I had lock, I had likely, I had maybe, I had doubtful. In the likely category, Durant, assuming he doesn't retire, he's in there for me as well. And then I have Harden, and then Karl Towns and Ben Simmons are the two younger guys outside of Giannis and AD that, like, something crazy would have to happen for them not to land there. And this is where, like, I'm not as high on Ben Simmons as some people. I don't necessarily think he's, like, the next Magic Johnson. But even if his ceiling is new age Jason Kidd or new age Draymond, who kind of does a little bit of everything and is just, like, a winning player, he's going to be in the top 10. It's just hard to imagine him falling out. He's too good at too many different things. And
well,
then
that sure sounds like
that,
he's a lock to me, Andrew. I mean, if he's hard to keep out and he's so good at so many things, that sounds like he should be in that lock category.
Well, I think the one thing with Simmons is that he is similar to Draymond in that he's going to be so much easier to appreciate if he's surrounded with the right pieces. And if he's not, there's a chance that people are going to look at him and focus more on his flaws than what he does well. Like if it's Simmons and three or four bums and Embiid is hurt and there's just not much to work with, then it could get a little trickier in terms of like assessing his value, fair or not. But you're right. Okay, so maybe you inch him closer to the lock category. But beyond that, it's pretty wide open.
Okay, next question for you. What about guys like Joel Embiid and Donovan Mitchell? What's holding you back from calling them locks? I mean, what do they need? Is it just health for Embiid, I'm assuming, or Mitchell you want to see more, or do you view them differently?
Yeah, well, that's the tough part, because Embiid is the guy. Like, if you told me Embiid was going to be healthy, he would be in the Giannis Anthony Davis category of guys who just, like, there's no way they're not dominating the league 4 or 5 years from now when some of these other guys recede. But at the same time, when you look at guys with health questions on this list, like Anthony Davis is not a guarantee to stay healthy for the next couple years. Porzingis has his own questions. I would say Kyrie also has some red flags that are worrisome. But like next to all those guys, the Embiid questions are still pretty serious. And like, knock on wood, let's hope for the best. But like, I don't feel great about betting on him making it through another 5 years healthy. Obviously, that's like the ideal outcome, but that gave me pause and I had him in like the maybe category.
Yeah, the trick that I was dealing with was not only are some of these guys facing injury issues, but they're also facing positional questions, right? So like Porzingis, for example, like I think we would normally think of a guy like him as sort of a lock when he's healthy, but when you're starting to see, okay, what's the game going to look like in 5 years? Is he going to be able to have that like, you know, top five level, you know, player type impact? Is he going to be winning on that level to sort of justify it? I mean, the questions do start to creep in. So I guess if I was using your categorization, I would think that Giannis Anthony Davis, Ben Simmons, and Embiid, if healthy, are locks. And that would be sort of my first group. And I would also be very, very confident that Durant and Harden were still in that top 10. I think the natural inclination in this exercise is to sort of, you know, just assume that these guys are going to fall off a cliff once they hit like 31, 32.
We don't want to correct too much for aging.
Yeah. And like, that's why I think looking back 5 years is helpful, because Chris Paul was number three on our list 5 years ago, and he's still probably a top 10 player. You know, I mean, it's close, it's debatable, but he's still definitely in that conversation. And he's a guy who I would expect to like have aged worse than either KD or Harden because of his size and, you know, because of his injury issues over the years as well. So I think we've almost got half the list, and then it becomes sort of like, you know, pick your flavor or pick your risk factor, right? It's like, you know, you've got guys like Porzingis, Kyrie with health issues. You've got maybe, you know, safer bets like a Tatum or a Mitchell. You could throw Towns into that safer bet category. A couple other names I think worth mentioning are Bradley Beal and Damian Lillard. I think both Beal and Lillard have the chance to sort of be like prime level players, maybe just a little bit, like maybe a year past what their peak production is going to be at that stage. But once these other players are sort of older and out of the picture, whether it's like the Westbrooks and the Chris Pauls of the world, for Lillard, I think his profile could sort of rise relatively. And then with Beal, you know, he's got a chance to be, you know, the best guy at his position, right? I mean, in a few years, it's not the world's greatest position. You know, it's not the deepest collection of talent, but I think he can be in that conversation, assuming he's able to continue the good health he's had here, you know, over the last year or so.
Yeah, and I'm a Bradley Beal believer, but even as someone who's been kind of on that bandwagon over the last few years, as I thought about this, I don't know. I think that if you're gonna hit that top 10 MVP candidate level, we generally see something in the first 4 or 5 years of a guy's career that makes us think, holy shit, like who knows where this can go. And we haven't really seen that with Beal. I do think that like if you're breaking this down strictly by age, he's going to be at the right point in his career to potentially be in this mix. But, you know, I also think that there are going to be some young guys that pop up and kind of edge him out, and he'll be at that Hayward, Jimmy Butler level where he'll be on the fringes, but probably not really in this mix. And to that end, I'm wondering like who it's gonna be. I mean, Donovan Mitchell will be 26 years old in 2023. Tatum will be 25. Devin Booker will be 26. But each of those guys has some real questions. It's funny that all this started with Tatum, because I'm starting to believe more and more that he will be in this mix as like kind of a two-way guy who can score at all three levels and play both ends. I mean, I don't know, because Booker is really good, but I could also see us turning around in 3 or 4 years and being like, this guy doesn't really do much beyond scoring.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm glad you were kind of talking yourself into Tatum. I didn't want to be a jerk, but I think that this exercise has proven that there's a very, very good chance he's going to wind up being a top 10 player, because the next generation of wing crop isn't as deep. And I think he's shown so much so early. You know, a great contrast would be with like Lonzo Ball. Like, did you even consider him for this list? You know, I didn't. No. If we went back a year ago, we might have said, hey, this guy could be in the mix. He could be one of the best point guards at his position. But you see like that early body of work, and it kind of, you know, mutes your expectations a little bit. And there's a bunch of guys from recent drafts where, you know, that's been the case too. Booker, you know how I stand on Booker. I need to see a heck of a lot more from him, and I'm not convinced there. I think Towns is an interesting one too, because he has the potential to get into that lock category, right? Like his best case scenario, he is as certified a star as basically any of these young guys. But you look at the way the playoffs played out, you look at some of the grumblings in Minnesota recently, you just, you know, kind of look at the holes that are still there in his game, even though he's made progress on numerous fronts, and you don't want to go all in with him maybe the same way you did 2 years ago. So I think there's a very good chance he'll be a top 10 guy, and I think he's probably in that likely category. But he's not necessarily someone I'm willing to just say 100% he's in. From this year's draft class, I'm curious, which players do you think have the best chance of being in this conversation? I've actually got three names. They're kind of all over the board, and they're kind of different percentage-wise in terms of, like, you know, whether I see them likely or unlikely. But the guys I could kind of see cracking this conversation, Luka Doncic, for sure. Yep. I think he's got that, you know, potential because of, you know, his skill set, where we've mentioned a lot of these guys don't have the ability to be like big time playmakers and do it all offensive guys. He fits that bill. I think the best case for Trae Young would have him like right on schedule to be a top 10 player, like at that point of his career. I'm not fully confident he's going to reach that. But here's the thing with Trae Young.
I really like Trae Young, but I also think that his ceiling is going to be about where Damian Lillard is now, which is to say, like, around the 15th best player in the league, and not necessarily someone who you can, like, build a title team around. So a really good player is what I'm hoping for from him, but I think even the best case scenario of Trae Young is probably on the outside of looking in if we're talking top 10 players.
Yeah, and in terms of the perception factor, we could easily be sitting here a year from now talking about Trae Young, how we're talking about Lonzo. Basically, like, lots of turnovers, poor efficiency as a rookie, and oh God, the sky is falling. So I'm just saying, like, he's a player I could see with that ceiling. The other guy after Summer League who I came away convinced could have a pretty high ceiling was actually Jaren Jackson Jr. for Memphis. I know that's maybe a little bit unconventional. Wasn't really what I was thinking in June, but when you just look at, like, physical tools, shooting ability, mobility, versatility, frame, you know, defensive awareness in terms of being able to really get up and contest and block shots above the rim, like, everything is sort of there for an absolute monster. Now, whether he gets there, I don't know if he will, but he's somebody who, you know, 5 years from now, if he was one of the younger members of that top 10 group and people were sort of forecasting him as, like, you know, a future all defensive type guy, you know, or an all NBA type candidate, you know, that wouldn't totally shock me. Did you have anybody else from this year's rookie class, like, in contention?
Yeah, I did. I had Wendell Carter Jr., Jaren Jackson Jr., and Luka Doncic. We had a lot of juniors in this year's draft, by the way. Random note. But those were the three who, you know, the best
case. Andrew,
what?
It's not just juniors. We got Marvin Bagley III. We got Lonnie Walker IV. What we're seeing here is the spawning of a new generation.
Yeah,
no
man,
doubt.
For real. That's the theme of this podcast, is the next generation. But yeah, I'm with you on Jaren Jackson Jr. And I put Wendell Carter in that conversation for the same reason, which is the best case version of their career leaves them looking like a version of what Draymond is now. And you had Draymond as the 10th best player in the NBA, which might have been a little high this past season, but I think, like, he's right there. And if they put it all together, the combination of the skills on offense and the defense and the ability to switch and kind of be that do everything big that can stay on the floor in playoff games is going to make them super, super valuable. So of the, like, really young guys where we're pretty much just guessing, I think Wendell Carter, Jaren Jackson, and Doncic, like, if all the Doncic believers on the internet are right about him, then he's going to be 24 years old at this point. And absolutely could be in the mix as one of the 10 best players in the league. Like, there's no reason he can't be better than Donovan Mitchell 5 years from now. I mean, we'll just kind of have to wait and see. The other two guys that I thought about, DeAndre Ayton has the tools, but I think the most likely outcome for him is going to be, like, Andre Drummond, but 15 or 20% better, which is still kind of a fringe all-star in the West, but probably not a guy who's, like, in the top 10. And then Lauri Markkanen, I'm still a big-time Lauri believer. He's going to need to get a lot more consistent to crack this conversation, but I think he belongs, like, on the bubble. And you know, like, keep an eye on him. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I don't see it with Ayton. I didn't even consider him. So
I know.
I don't know if that says more about me
or
him.
You've made it very clear that you don't see it with Ayton.
Yeah, but I'd also say, like, this list, you know, the top 10 list is usually going to be dominated by guys in their late 20s, right? So that goes for Ayton even Luka, like you were mentioning, Trey, I mentioned earlier, like the odds that they're going to be top 10 players in their career are much better than that they're going to necessarily be top 10 guys just 5 years like, from now, right? Like usually, yeah, you're looking at the guys who are sort of like in their second, third, fourth, fifth seasons right now who are going to be in that group in the future. So just keep that in mind. It's not like we're writing these players off forever. In terms of Wendell Carter Jr., I loved his play at Summer League. I think he's going to be a really good and nice fit for Chicago. I do wonder, though, will he have the perception factor, right? Like, if everybody compares him to Al Horford, did anyone ever put Al Horford in the top 10 conversation really at any point, over the last 5 years? They didn't. So I might be a little bit lower on him than you were. I'm glad you mentioned Lowry because I wanted to bring him up, as well as your other favorite pet project, Brandon Ingram. And you know, you're always talking up Ingram's future potential. And look, I haven't forgotten that you were also talking up D'Angelo Russell, and you just conveniently have amnesia about him and haven't mentioned him for the last 2 years. And I'm worried the same thing is going to happen to Ingram here in a couple years. But these guys, Lowry and Ingram, like your two little, you know, your pride and joy, if you want to call them, what do you think the chances are that they do become top 10 players at some point?
Well, I like Lowry's intangibles more than Ingram's, and I think that's my worry with Ingram is that he doesn't have that kind of killer instinct, that like fuck you gene that Giannis has, and I think that the tools with Ingram are superior to everything Lowry has, and superior to just about anything any other young player is bringing to the table. Like if you're looking at guys who are in their first 3 years, but I'm still waiting to see that gene that like all the best players in the league have, which is just like, he's going to go take over a game. And I don't know if that he's going to have a better chance of developing that with LeBron there. And so I think that like, I would expect Ingram to land somewhere between 10 and 20, like when we're looking at things in 5 years.
Well, that's a lot higher than Wiggins is at currently, so you're still higher on him
right.
than I am.
He's better than Wiggins. He's not going to turn into Andrew Wiggins. I promise everyone listening, he's going to be fine. He's going to be awesome next year. He's just probably never going to be that like all NBA superstar that you build a team around. And by the way, looking at the top 10, because I went back and looked at your top 100 this year, and you know, you look at, you had LeBron 1, KD 2, Steph 3, Kawhi 4, Harden 5, Westbrook 6, CP3 7, Anthony Davis 8, Giannis 9, Draymond 10. It's kind of crazy to think about, but all 10 of those guys, granted Kawhi is a question mark as we covered on the last podcast, but most of those guys are locks for the Hall of Fame. So when we're talking about guys who are going to be in the top 10, like if the talent remains as deep as it has been, we're basically predicting like Hall of Famers here.
That's a great point. So just to wrap up here, 5 years from now, I think Towns will probably be in. I think Beal has a shot. I think Booker will be out. I'm still probably a little bit lower on Lowry than you, but I agree he belongs in that bubble. Ingram, not sure I see it. I think he'll probably be outside the top 10. Another guy we haven't mentioned is Jokic. I think that he is going to kind of get labeled as a one-way guy, and so he'll always be behind like the Porzingis, Embiid, faction at his position. But I do think he's going to be kind of a mainstay in this top 20 discussion, just because Denver's offense is going to be so amazing, basically throughout this current contract that he just signed. Lillard and Kyrie, in terms of like the current point guards who still have a chance to kind of be hanging around in 5 years, I think that they would be in the mix as well. I'm out on Westbrook. I'm out on Curry because he'd be 35 at that point. I'm out on LeBron.
Really?
But
that was going to be my final question, because 39-year-old LeBron, I don't know if I'm completely out. Like he probably won't be a top five player. No, look, I'm give it
just
everything
trying to make headlines right now, Andrew. Come on, you're trying to make headlines.
Look, Kobe was still kicking at 39, and LeBron's game
is going
to be a better fit. Wait, let's see when Kobe retired. I think he was. He was still playing.
No, he definitely
right?
He wasn't kicking. Whatever he was doing on the court, he wasn't kicking. He might have been bricking, but he was not kicking at 39.
He was definitely bricking. But I think that Kobe's final season, he was 37. Okay, so 39 might be asking a lot. But look, this is like the most outrageous athlete we've seen in the last 50 years in American sports. So all bets are off when it comes to LeBron and his million-dollar training regimen. I could see him out there, if anything, because we know he wants to play with his son.
Yeah, so I think there's a chance that LeBron would still be a top 25 player 5 years from now. I'm not willing to go to top 10, but that's okay. What I was going to ask you, because you brought up the juniors and the thirds and the fourths. I mean, here's a better question for you. Over the course of the next however many 50 years, what's the over-under on number of seasons that LeBron James Jr. is considered a top 10 player in the NBA? I want to set the over-under at, let's say, 2.5. What do you take, over or under?
I'm going to go under. That.
Oh.
LeBron Jr. is going to have a lot to work through. I mean, look, by the way, this is peak off-season content here. We can get into Zion Wade and Keon Anthony and Chris Paul's kid. Like, let's dive into the next generation of the banana boat. But
look,
no,
Andrew, you're showing no respect to LeBron James Jr.'s national championship in AAU that his
team
just won.
That's the headline, yeah. LeBron James Jr., already overrated.
I'm going over, actually. I think he's going to do it, Andrew. I've got complete faith. Also, I think that, like, you know, LeBron, if nothing else, once he gets tired of, like, you know, perfectly manicuring situations for himself, won't he just naturally shift into like perfectly manicuring situations for his son, whether he's a GM or an owner? Maybe he can be a player coach. Whatever LeBron to put his son in position to get stats and to chase rings in the NBA, I believe LeBron will be able to do it. Therefore,
actually, though,
over.
Hold on. That might be the best reason of all to doubt this, because if we're talking about LeBron's ability to manicure his own situations, his track record isn't great, okay? Well, the last couple years in Cleveland, whatever the hell is going on in LA this summer, which I'm sure we could touch on later in the podcast. I don't know. Maybe LeBron is trying to sort of like mastermind things for his son, and I don't know if that's a good thing for LeBron Jr.
I hear you that it might not be the best in terms of like collecting rings and like his talent eye isn't, you know, perfect by any stretch. But he has been the number one ranked guy on SI's top 100 every single year that I've done it, right? So if we're talking about positioning for like maximum credit and valor and sort of like hero worship, LeBron has that mastered. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I can see that skill, his ability to put his son in the center of the ring, you know, his favorite, like, you know, Roosevelt quote that he's always, you know, the man in the arena. He is going to have LeBron James Jr. as the man in the arena, no doubt about it. For that reason, I'm going over on my own line that I just made up. And by the way, like, gambling websites in Costa Rica and Vegas, Atlantic City, get on this. Like, this is a line that we need to have public. I don't encourage gambling, but this is the type of thing we should be discussing.
Yeah, this is a real future bet, you know? Invest your money for 6 years with the Mandalay Bay. Anyways, getting back to this year's talent pool, Brandon asks, who is going to have the better year next season? Blake Griffin or DeMar DeRozan? And you know what, Ben? In honor of the extension that he signed with Cleveland this afternoon, I want to add Kevin Love to that mix as well. So let's make the question, who is going to have the better year, Blake, DeMar, or Kevin Love in Cleveland? What do you think?
This is just such a bleak question. You know, it's like, but just take the cities, you know, like, imagine you're like a big time all-star level player, like, where do you want to live and enjoy your career? Cleveland, Detroit, or San Antonio? It's like perfect. Like, okay, well, how do I do the process of elimination to like arrive at the one I believe is going to be, you know, the least painful? I think the safest money right now would be on DeMar. I think his, in terms of health, I think he's got the fewest red flags. You know, I think obviously Blake Griffin's got a long history of medical issues, but I think Kevin Love, like in the immediate aftermath of that contract today, I didn't think nearly enough people were talking about his list of health issues that he's had. To commit that much money for multiple years to him, given those issues, would have made me, you know, think twice, think three times, think four times, hang up the phone, think five times. So I think DeMar is probably set up the best for success, but still, I don't love the fit there in San Antonio. I think they're going to be working through a lot offensively. And then I was reading a piece, I believe, by James Herbert at CBSSports.com, which made a great point about the Spurs. They've lost a lot of perimeter defense between Kawhi, Danny Green, and then also you could throw in Kyle Anderson as well. And DeMar, you know, is just not that guy on the wing. So I think, you know, their vaunted sort of league-leading defense status they've had here in recent years is definitely going to be put to the test next season. So I don't love any of these situations, but I think that San Antonio will have the most wins of those three teams. I think DeMar has the least health risk. I think Pop will be creative in utilizing him and understand what he can and can't do and coaxing him towards, you know, more efficient play. So you know, I'm talking myself into DeMar, even though that's very, very painful.
Yeah. Well, it kind of depends on how you define success, right? Because better year statistically, I think I would go with Blake having a better year statistically. He'll probably make an all-star game. DeMar DeRozan won't. And that's one thing that we didn't totally explain on the Kawhi emergency podcast. But like DeMar, to make the all-star game as a guard in the West, you basically have to be like all NBA caliber. I mean, even Chris Paul didn't make the all-star game last season. And it's just going to be really tough for DeMar. I think that he's going to win somewhere between 47 and 52 games. So, like, if that's how you define success and contentment, then maybe DeMar will win this battle. The Love thing is really interesting, though. I had the exact same reaction, in part because once I saw that he re-signed and he's really going to stay in Cleveland, I started to think about him and the fantasy numbers that he's going to be putting up next season. I mean, the obvious takeaway is to say, all right, so Love is going to stay there, put up 25 and 15 for the next 8 months. He's probably going to win like 35 games, but he'll be happy. He'll be getting his numbers. But then I did start to wonder, like, you know, we haven't seen Kevin Love put together many extended stretches of health since he's been in Cleveland. And I think that should be a real concern for the Cavs. And I also wonder whether the Cavs did this with the intent of trying to trade him next summer, which, you know, that's much harder to read and it's pure speculation on our part. But like, I think that's the one way you can read this and say that it was a smart move is say, look, we've got Kevin Love locked up. And as teams go into next summer looking for stars and then strike out, Love will actually be a pretty attractive trade asset.
Yeah, so real quick, first on Blake, he hasn't played 70 games since 2014 in a season. You know, if we had gone back 5 years ago, we almost certainly would have bet he would be a top 10 player. Now
yeah,
he's
that's a great
nowhere
point.
Near that conversation. And so I look forward to next season. Like, he may sneak into the All-Star game if he can stay healthy early on, but are we going to view his season as a success given, you know, his inability to stay on the court and, you know, this,
you know
the
what?
Regularity with which he misses long stretches?
I should have clarified, you know, that's, there, though. Yeah. What I'm thinking with Blake is that we're due for at least one more good Blake season. And I think it's going to come next season before things start to really unravel. And he's making like $45 million a year and playing like 50 games a year. Because everyone understands that the back end of that contract is going to get dark. But I Blake is so talented and the East is already kind of watered down at this point. He's got to have at least 1 year because I can't, it's too depressing to think about the alternative.
Yeah, but like the front end of this contract's pretty dark too. I mean, the stretch run for Detroit was rough.
I'm aware.
And what I'm saying is, like, outside of trying to play his way into another trade, what's his motivation? You know what I mean? Like if you realize you're not going to be who you used to be a few years ago, you realize you can't contend for a title, you realize you're in Detroit and you're never going to be able to really upgrade, you know, meaningfully the talent around you, you realize you don't necessarily fit with Andre Drummond. I mean, to me, that's a really tough mental test for Blake. And like, even if he turns in like a fantastic, like, career type year, next year, like, isn't his best case scenario playing his way into a trade so he can be somewhere he would actually want to be, rather than, you know, stuck in an organization that traded for him and then blew up their whole front office? Like, I don't know. That just seems like the type of scenario I don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah, but in terms of maybe Blake is playing for the off seasons at this point.
Yeah, and in terms of Kevin Love, I think it was very similar to San Antonio's thinking of, like, look, if we can't be great, we want to try to be good. And I think the problem is that they don't have enough other talent there around him to really be good. And so it is going to create that, you know, expectations chasm where it's like they really want to be a playoff team. They don't have enough to really be a playoff team. You know, Kevin Love is going to, you know, temporarily in the short term, enjoy the greater touches in the larger offensive role and getting his numbers. But, you know, to what end? I mean, I think that's going to get old pretty quickly once you realize that, you know, a lot of the veterans around them, you know, aren't contributing on the same level without LeBron. Once you realize that, you know, your organizational goal should really be to develop Colin Sexton as much as possible. That means losing, you know, quite a bit in the short term. That's going to get a little bit old. So I think their hope was to kind of, you know, cover both paths, right? Be respectable here in the short term and then try to trade Love at some point. I mean, I think a Love, you know, with that contract is kind of a trade asset, you know, basically immediately, you know, but then also over the next couple of years. And I think that's why they did it the way they are. I didn't love it. You know, if I were them, I would have, you know, I think they probably gave him that money because they tried to trade him this summer and didn't find much interest given his contract status. So they figured this was better than nothing. But to me, that's an awful lot of money for a guy who, you know, even when he was, you know, his peak individual production really wasn't winning a lot of games in Minnesota. And I still question, okay, even if he does bring, you know, this 25, 15, you know, numbers that you're mentioning back, is that going to translate to winning? I don't see it, you know, even in the Eastern Conference. And so what do those numbers really get you?
Fantasy winning.
Yeah, well, who cares about fantasy? I mean, only Harry Potter nerds, you know?
Yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you. I know, I with the Love thing, I see it going a Blake Griffin direction with the caveat that I think if they turn around a year from now and start looking to trade Love, it will be after a kind of an underwhelming Cavs season where they win 30 or 35 games, and the it'll be kind of a mutually beneficial move to send him elsewhere, and Kevin Love will be on board, in part because Cleveland is not LA and the Cavs have no shot at making the playoffs. At least that's what we think now. Who knows how good they'll be. I mean, that like 7-8 spot in the East is still pretty wide open.
Let me ask you this, though. Will the Blake Griffin experience scare off GMs from trading for Kevin Love a year from now, right? Or, like, at the trade deadline, for example? Like, once you see how badly that backfired for Detroit, when you realize, like, just trying to get a big name to put some butts in the seats and we'll see how it goes, and, like, you know, he's probably going to be overpaid for the last couple of years of the deal, but we're just going to, like, roll the dice and then immediately get Stan Van fired. Will that whole experience, will people take lessons from that and, you know, basically stay away and basically leave Kevin Love stuck in Cleveland? I think that could happen.
It's definitely possible, but I also think you're forgetting just how many teams are clearing out cap space for next summer with the intention of signing superstars, most of whom are going to end up being on the same team somewhere, whether it's LA, whether it's New York. Like, the market gets fairly thin once you get past, like, I mean, Al Horford probably isn't leaving Boston. Kyrie, if he leaves Boston, he's probably teaming up with KD. And, like, there aren't going to be that many options, and there are going to be teams out there who can't afford to just keep kicking the can down the road. Like, there are a number of teams, Brooklyn is one of them, where, like, the moves that they've made look awesome on the NBA internet, and everybody just kind of looks up and says, oh man, Brooklyn is staying flexible, they've got space for two superstars. But if they don't sign a superstar, like, I don't know, trading for a guy like Kevin Love and making the playoffs isn't the worst thing in the world. Given everything we know about that Nets front office, they probably won't go that direction. But, like, if the Sixers strike out, like, adding Love to catch and shoot threes from Ben Simmons for the next couple of years wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. I think there may be more of a market than you realize.
Well, first thing on Brooklyn, I'm with you. The lengths that people have to stretch to praise them is crazy. Do you know they're the only team at Summer League out of 30 teams not to win a single game? I mean, aren't they supposed to be trying to sell hope in the future?
That's amazing.
They can't even win a single Summer League game. What are these guys doing? You know, it's like, are you playing for now? Are you playing for the future? Like all these brilliant, you know, salary cap draft pick moves, and they're still the biggest losers in the league. On Kevin Love, I'm worried maybe that it winds up being a Melo in New York situation where, like, very early in the contract, it becomes clear that, like, he's their best player and they don't have a lot of help around him. And what's the point? But they don't want to trade him because that admit, you know, that's kind of like admitting a mistake. So you try to juggle the pieces around him, but it doesn't work. And then there's 2 years left on the deal. And finally, you trade him for kind of, you know, not a huge return. And then eventually he gets bought out. And it just kind of winds up being a waste of time. And, like, that was a really sad way for this to end. I just don't think Kevin Love is good enough to command a big time package. I think if you're a true contender, you don't view him at this point going forward as a top three guy. And if you're paying him that much money and he's not a top three guy, then you can't afford to bring him in, right? So I think he's kind of stuck for a weird purgatory. I mean, congratulations to him. He looked really excited to sign that contract surrounded by all the construction workers in Cleveland. I mean, kind of weird optics there.
I don't really know what they were going for. Yeah, the whole thing was weird. And it, by the way, it's just very funny sometimes how our roles change on this podcast, because we had a conversation about Kevin Love probably about 6 weeks ago, and I was the guy who was being the asshole saying, you know, Kevin Love is just not that great, and this is going to get a little depressing going forward. But now, today, because of the construction worker photo, and because I like Cavs fans, and they've had kind of a rough couple of weeks, I'm trying to be glass half full on this, but you're ultimately correct, just as I was correct 6 weeks ago, where, like, I don't know, this probably isn't going to be that great for Kevin Love or the Cavs, but well, I really like Kevin Love.
A big thing
the
happened
person.
In the last 6 weeks, yeah, but a big thing happened in the last 6 weeks, and that is Kevin Love got a gigantic bag of future money. You know, like, I like Kevin Love as a trade asset when he's only on that one-year deal and you're renting him as your third guy, or you're Cleveland, you're trying to, like, race to the bottom, you trade Kevin Love, you get a couple nice pieces back, and you have a very clear definition of who you're going to be next season with no pressure. That's not what they did. Instead, they went the other way. They signed him up for all this money. They've taken on the risk of his health. They've taken on the expectations that comes with having a guy on that type of salary number. And they're praying for an eighth seed in a conference where the eighth seed is, you know, worthless. I mean, you know, might as well just be tanking at that point. I don't love that. I don't think that makes me kind of a hypocrite based on, I mean, I think that's a pretty consistent position. It's easy to love a guy when there's a financial flexibility attached compared to what just happened.
Yeah, no, it's more me who today I just don't have the heart to crush Kevin Love or the Cavs or any of this. Let's just pretend that this is going to work out, because, again, Kevin Love seems like a good guy. He has a sense of humor about himself. And he's now very, very wealthy. So the
sad part is, I feel like that was their logic too. Like, I feel like they didn't have the heart to trade him, so they just gave him as much money as possible and said, "Let's just figure it out. Maybe it'll work. Obviously, it won't. But let's just talk ourselves into it." That kind of seems like what Dan Gilbert and their front office was doing on this one.
Yeah. Well, moving on here to another team with questionable logic. Dylan says, "Hey guys, please play the clip of Dwight's press conference on the next podcast. I have a feeling Andrew just read the quote and then refused to watch the video, and I think he needs to be put through the pain of that terrible, 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 prolonged joke." So, fine. We'll give you what you want, Dylan. Here is the clip. One second.
What is it about this situation that makes you proclaim such a bold statement right now?
Actually, I was joking with my trainer earlier today, and I thought it'd be fitting. But we were just talking about how, you know, I started with the Magic. So I learned Magic for 8 years. Traveled to La La Land. Learned how to work with Rockets. then I went to learn how to fly with some Hawks. Got stung by the Hornets. This is a joke. But through all of that, you know, it's taught me how to be a wizard, you know. So
All right. Well, this is my life now, Ben. I kept the video going so you could hear the applause in the background. What did you think of that?
Was that you clapping, or who was that?
Well, I'll have...
Were you there both... in person for that amazing rendition of Comedy Hour?
Yes. For the record, Dylan, I was in the room when Dwight said that, and so I didn't have to watch the video. Yeah, so there were fans that they had brought in for this press conference for like a Dwight meet and greet beforehand. So they were kind of sitting next to the reporters during all of this. And
Okay, hold on. Were they real fans or are they paid fans? I mean, what are we? Are we just like filling the stands with actors, or these are real fans?
Honestly, I couldn't quite tell whether it was like a season ticket holder situation or this was like a charity thing. It was a strange cross-section of people who were in the room. There were a lot of kids there, but yeah, in the room, that joke killed, and everybody started applauding and laughing, and I was looking around kind of in shock, in horror. I told someone at the press conference, it kind of feels like this is God trying to convince me to stop caring about the Wizards, but it's not going to work, because I am still completely all in on this decision and the year of Dwight and the year of the Wizards taking things to their logical extreme. And I did appreciate Dwight. My only real reaction to that quote is when he first started out, I enjoyed him trying to keep it off the cuff and say, well, actually, as if this all came out naturally and wasn't rehearsed. And then when he started, I thought he was going to say, I started with the Magic, and now I'm ready to finish with the Wizards, which would have been corny on its own, but, you know, just sort of a throwaway line. But then he went all in on that bullshit journey, and I appreciate that the Wizards are going to be getting, like, the full Dwight experience. We're not getting a toned-down Dwight trying to just kind of keep his head down and do the right things and show people that he's changed. This is Dwight at his Dwightest.
Yeah, look at you trying to underrate Dwight's corniness to talk yourself into him being on your team. That backfired badly. I liked how he was pausing after each stop, kind of trying to mentally remember all the different places he had been, because you'll remember like a month or two ago where I tried to get you to like off the top of your head, you know, list off all of his stops in order, and it was not the world's easiest decision. So he definitely had to practice, just given how, you know, crazy this whole lineup has been. But I will say this, the feeling, the sensation I had watching that press conference was identical to the feeling and sensation I had watching the most recent Borat special on Showtime. Have you seen it yet? Or you've probably heard about it on Twitter?
Yeah, I've definitely heard about it.
Okay, first of all, Elizabeth, don't watch it, okay? It's not age appropriate for you. Andrew, it is so uncomfortable. I mean, there's these situations, not only with the politicians, but just like there's an art curator. There's just all these different people who he's just completely getting inside their heads, messing with them, making them say the most outrageously kind of shameful and awkward and personal moments. It's the kind of show where like you want to cover your eyes and your ears simultaneously, and you're just like moving your hands back and forth to just kind of like get out of it. That's how I felt watching and listening to the Dwight Howard press conference. Can I just say, the fact that you were actually there, which I didn't know until just now, makes it 10 times worse, because you should be scarred from this. You should be coming on here with the fury of just 1,000 like spited gods and just freaking out. And the fact that you're so calm, it actually is making me, Andrew, honestly, it's making me pity you. And I never can really say that I've ever felt that before.
I'm good with it.
I love arguing with you. I officially pity you for this.
Look, I appreciate Dwight being himself. I also appreciate that he took that quote in super slow motion. So it was like watching a car crash unfold in real time. And there were other moments in the press conference that certainly gave me pause. I'm not here to tell you that I'm just like emotionless now, because when he sat up there and said, not only do I intend to play 8 more years, I intend to retire a Washington Wizard. I mean, that's a lot to take in. If Dwight is going to spend the next 8 years on the Wizards, I'm fucking out. All right, so I'll say that right now. But I did also spend time talking to people down there, and like, people are sleeping on the Wizards, Ben. I don't want to overplay this right now. It's the middle of the summer. The bottom line is, John Wall is not as bad as he looked last season, and if he can be 80% of the player he was a couple years ago, or 80 to 90%, like, look, the ceiling on this team is still fairly high. I mean, Markieff Morris last summer was on trial for assault all summer, and so he showed up out of shape.
You told us last summer they were going to make the finals, and now you're going to try to spin it like they were in such a bad place last summer. We know what you're up to, Andrew.
I'm not here to tell you that I have any credibility with respect to the Wizards. All I'm saying is that I'm beginning to get a little bit excited about what's possible here, and you know, I'm willing to tolerate Dwight and his role in everything if he can be a slightly better version of Marchand Gortat. The one thing I do think is funny. Dwight still talks and acts as if he's like a superstar and still kind of a top 10 guy. And that's going to be an interesting experiment, because he's not going to be happy if he's sitting on the bench for the fourth quarter. But like, his game doesn't really fit with the shape of the league right now.
Andrew, it won't be interesting, because we've seen it for the last 4 years, time and time again, in all the different situations that he mentioned. A hornet stung me. We heard all those things. It was the same script every time. It screwed up and didn't work in every single one of those situations. He's had the same issues kind of getting over himself. It's not going to work. You sound like you're way too close to the storm. You know, you're like, you're in the middle of the hurricane. You're saying,
it's
only raining a little bit. You're in the middle of the earthquake. Hey, this is kind of fun. My room's shaking. And the next thing you know, complete devastation. I think you actually misheard what he said, because he said, I'm going to retire with the Washington Wizards. What he actually said, I believe, or what he meant was, I'm going to retire the Washington Wizards, a.k.a. he's taking the whole franchises out behind the barn, putting it out of its misery. There's a good chance your franchise is going to be done within the next 5 years, thanks solely to Dwight Howard.
Well, I'm good with that, too. Given the way the last 25 years have gone, I'm okay with however this ends. And you're right, I am in the middle of the hurricane, and I have no choice but to just hang out and enjoy the breeze while we're here. But anyways, that's the next chapter in the Dwight Chronicles. We'll try to keep you guys updated throughout the season. Moving on for the time being, so that we don't get more concerned letters from listeners. Gayton says, should the Minnesota Timberwolves be working on a Clippers-esque demotion for Tom Thibodeau? This is the one thing we haven't really talked very much about over the last month. There have been a lot of Lakers, a lot of Thunder. Like, the offseason's gotten crazy. Quietly, though, the Wolves are just a mess right now. And, like, it seems like this is a story that's probably going to bubble up in, like, November. And people are going to look up and say, holy shit, like, what's going on in Minnesota? But Towns hasn't signed his extension. They're going into next season with a ton of pressure to try and recruit Jimmy Butler to stay. Wiggins is sort of AWOL, and no one really understands what their plans are with him. They couldn't trade him this summer. There's just a lot going on, and Tibbs is at the center of most of it.
Well, let me just say this. I've dubbed Andrew Sharp Reports as your time to just have 30 seconds to just unload your true feelings, and people have loved that. I think I might need like a Grandpa G's, you know, like rocking chair chronicles to unload my old man takes.
Yes.
And this is going to be the first one. I only need 10 seconds for this one, because this is going to definitely date me, make me sound like I'm 60. I wish Karl-Anthony Towns had been as excited about his first playoffs as he was as excited to hand out the free custom codes for the Diamond Pink 99 whatever NBA 2K that he handed out on Twitter the other night. The guy was so into the NBA 2K social media giveaway like 3 months after laying the biggest egg in the playoffs. And to me, that's a red flag. That's all I've got.
Okay, I thought you were going to take it in another direction. I loved Honest Golliver a week into this past NBA season saying Tom Thibodeau is past his prime and the Wolves should move on. I don't know if a Clippers-esque demotion for Thibodeau, which to be clear, the Clippers stripped Doc Rivers of his GM duties. I don't know if that's enough. I think they might just need to sort of cut ties with Tibbs, and it may already be too late. I mean, the shit, like bringing in Derrick Rose is borderline malpractice when Tyus Jones is sitting there and has been really solid for them as a backup point guard. And now Rose is there and he's going to get like 20, 25 minutes a game under Tibbs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the least of their concerns. I mean, I think the Wiggins situation, how that was handled, the progress that Towns and Wiggins are or are not showing, the locker room dynamic between Butler and the younger stars, the minutes that all of these guys are logging. I mean, those are the real big fundamental questions. And I think, unfortunately for Minnesota and their fans, I think they're stuck. I mean, I think they kind of like picked their partner. Thibodeau has gone exactly by the same blueprint that we would have expected. He's really shown no signs of adapting or altering his strategic approach to any of these issues. He's really just doubled down. And I think the fact that they weren't able to lock up Jimmy and then now he's going to be in a position to really, you know, be a power player potentially next summer in terms of putting together a super team has got to scare the life out of them, because they have two players who matter on their roster. It's Jimmy and Towns, and neither one of those guys is at this point as we're talking locked in. Now you would assume, you know, Towns is eventually going to take his money, but you know, if I'm them, I don't see it. Like, it feels like there's not really a way for them to clearly build on what happened last year. I mean, I think their offseason was basically, you know, lateral move after lateral move, you know, nothing splashy in terms of positive additions. And their overall philosophy is just whatever Tom wants to do, Tom gets to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's going to, you know, pay off here in the short term or the long term. And unfortunately, I think it's going to take them, you know, a solid 2 or 3 years to figure that out. I mean, if their ownership group has showed us anything in the last decade, it's that they don't know how dumb they are, right?
Right.
Like, David Kahn was in that position for an awfully long time. They had other chief decision makers making a series of questionable decisions, you know, whether it's draft picks or other roster moves. And I think, unfortunately, they view Tibbs as like, at least the front office and the ownership groups views him as like the best thing that's ever happened to them, because he got them back in the playoffs.
In some ways,
he ended the
he
drought.
Is. Yeah, in some ways he is, because he's sort of accelerated things and made the Wolves relevant to a degree that they hadn't been for the previous 10 years. But the reason I mentioned the Rose signing is because it's indicative of like half-baked thinking that has informed almost every move Minnesota has made for the last 2 years. And now their hands are kind of tied. And, you know, as a coach, Tibbs should take heat for the lack of development and the lack of growth we've seen from Towns and Wiggins. And I think some of what Towns has struggled with defensively is probably related to the scheme that he's being asked to play, and they haven't found a way to help him. And part of that's on the coaches. And then there's also kind of just vague internal stuff that we'll hear throughout the summer. I mean, Tibbs fired a bunch of people back in May, some of whom were close to Kat, and there's just been like weird friction with like the business side of the Wolves and the whole thing. I think even people who were skeptical of Thibodeau taking on that dual role of GM and coach would not have predicted it would go this poorly this quickly, but that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, I think the Wiggins situation is very instructive. I think a smart franchise this summer, like a leading franchise, would have acknowledged the issues with that contract in his future, traded him for young assets before the secret was completely out, tried to fleece a team like the Sacramento Kings who'd be willing to talk themselves into him.
The Kings are always available.
Yeah, that was what a smart franchise would have done. I think, a somewhat aware franchise would have kept talking itself into Wiggins and said, okay, well, the last couple of years haven't really gone well, so what can we do? How do we build up his confidence? How do we talk him up in public? How do we line him up with certain, you know, advisors and people who can help, you know, fill in the holes of his game and really make him feel empowered? And I think what a dumb organization would do is run it back with a coach and a star player in Jimmy Butler, who just basically takes shots at him constantly. And, you know, in a situation where he already seems willing to check out at a moment's notice, and now you've got people yelling at you about your effort level, your defense, you're eating second or third most nights, you're not in a situation where you're the number one guy, and you're just going to continue along with that plan without any meaningful sort of public, you know, shift in tone or focus or roster changes. That seems like a terrible idea that's bound to end in failure, and good luck.
Yeah, well, it's a big year, because the other thing is, if they go out and win 55 games and look great and make the second round of the playoffs,
that,
or make
that's
the
not
going to
happen, Andrew. Why do you put these
saying,
if situations out there? That's not going to happen. Come on.
Look, but I'm trying to be Mr. Glass half full today, okay? It's all is not lost for the Wolves yet. And there just happens to be a ton of pressure on them for the next 6 or 7 months. And there aren't that many reasons for optimism. But if they can pull a kick-ass season out of thin air here, things could start to look very different by the time we have this conversation next summer.
For sure. I mean, if you and I get sponsored by Mercedes-Benz and we're both rolling in $150,000, you know, luxury vehicles, things could really be looking positive for us next year, Andrew.
Okay. Well, there you go. So thank you for bringing us back to reality. Moving
that's
on.
That's not
though.
Glass half full. That's like you've drank in three glasses of something.
The glass is broken on the floor. Lucas says, hey guys, what do you think of Jabari Parker's statement that he's not paid to play defense? And for anyone who missed it, Jabari Parker said last week, I just stick to my strengths. Look at everybody in the league. They don't pay players to play defense. There's only two players historically who play defense. I can't believe that's a real quote. I'm not going to say that I won't play defense, but to say that's a weakness is like saying that's everybody's weakness. I've scored 30s and 20s off of guys who say they try to play defense. Ben, Lucas asked for our reaction to this. My reaction was that I am pissed off that I've spent the last 2.5 years podcasting with you, and you have slowly but surely broken me down to where last week I was comparing Jabari to Jahlil Okafor and questioning whether he has a place in this league. I read this quote, and I, number one, agreed with a lot of it, and number two, it reminded me that Jabari Parker is absolutely a bucket getter after my own heart, and I should be rooting for him next year. So I'm going to try and correct that going forward.
I was absolutely disgusted by what he said and disgusted by what you just said. He's trying too hard to be the next Melo. We understand he got those comps coming into the NBA, but you're not Melo. Don't adopt this Melo-like approach. I mean, he might as well have just put a picture of himself on Instagram sipping wine with a butler in the streets as he answered this question. I mean, it's, you know, Melo-esque defiance. Look, he's not wrong. I mean, that's true. He didn't get paid for his defense because he doesn't play any. We definitely know that. But if I were him, I wouldn't be so confident he's going to be getting paid as a scorer going forward. Now, but here's in his defense, though, Andrew, this guy's been through an awful lot of traumatic experiences in his NBA career. It's good to be confident. It's good to talk yourself into, you know, what you do well. I think there was definitely times last season where it didn't seem like he was still that same scorer, like that guy who could just go get those buckets. And I think if nothing else, like if you're really trying to spin this from a Bulls fan perspective, you want a confident Jabari Parker next season. If you're paying him $20 million, you can't have gun shy, oh, I'm just going to keep the ball moving and hope Larry carries us Jabari Parker. You need a guy who views himself as a number one option if you're going to go anywhere. So I guess, you know, the alternative could be worse. But I would just say, you know, and take this for what it's worth, Jabari, you know, you're probably listening. You might try playing some defense. It is important, and you will wind up getting paid for it. A lot of guys do actually get paid for their defense in
the
modern
thing.
NBA.
Here is the real issue with what Jabari Parker said. There's some truth to what he's saying there. I mean, they don't pay players to play defense. I think if you look at the top 10 players in the league, some of them are very good on defense, but a lot of them are so good on offense that their holes on defense don't really matter. And Jabari's issue is that his offense has never been that great in the NBA. He's put together a couple weeks here and there where he's started to look great, and then he always kind of regresses back to a chucker who's not very efficient and is not worth the investment on offense. And so that's the issue. Like, I'm with you, Jabari. We just need to work on your offense, but I completely support your defense allergy. And I think that it, you know, other players, Melo is a great example of a guy who made it work because he was that incredible on offense. And that's the issue with Jabari.
Did he make it work for who? Who did he make it work
for?
Oh,
fuck you. He made it work for like 15 years. It's not currently working. I won't argue with you there, but it did work for like 10 of 15 years. He was great.
Yeah, I must have missed those 10 years that it was working so fantastic, but I think he made one conference finals. But anyway,
your point
is taken. I think he's flirting with some dangerous ideas here. You know, like if he's going to just walk all the way into ideas. You know, this scenario and just be like, I'm a one-way guy. Sorry, defense is somebody else's prerogative on this team. He is going to be looking around with, you know, upward turned hands and shrugged shoulders at Zach LaVine and Markkanen and the other guys on that roster. They're all going to be pointing fingers at each other because it seems like pretty much their entire core, besides Wendell Carter, has that attitude towards defense, and you're not going anywhere with that attitude.
There you go. Well, that, by the way, calling those dangerous ideas, that is the true distillation of Grandpa Golliver in his rocking chair speaking to the next generation. So I appreciate
The rocking chair chronicles are here to stay, okay?
There you go. One more question before we have... We have a couple podium questions. Return to the podium. Eric says, there's been a lot of talk over the Lakers free agent signings made since they got LeBron. Knowing that the Lakers were trying to protect 2019 cap space, what other one-year deals did you want them to make? I will say I really wanted them to sign Wayne Ellington. I don't understand why more contenders didn't go after Wayne Ellington. Like, Ellington's from Philly, would have been a great fit with the Sixers, and there was never much interest there, apparently. And he would have been a great fit next to LeBron as kind of a guy who can just spot up around LeBron and just nail threes all season. So I don't understand why they didn't go that direction. And I would have just brought back Brook Lopez instead of going and getting JaVale McGee. But the broader conversation, the Lakers have now completed their summer by bringing in Michael Beasley. What did you think of that move?
What do you think I thought of that move? Come on, Andrew. That one writes itself. Look, I think this question misframes what happened this summer for the Los Angeles Lakers, because you keep cap space open for next summer as a backup plan. Like, your main plan was to assemble a super team around LeBron James. That is historically what's happened. LeBron has never been playing for a year from now and seeing who we can get a year from now. That's never been really his MO here over the last, 8 or 9 years. And so who they got on these one-year contracts is almost irrelevant. You're supposed to be putting together a core group of A-list talent that's going to be ready to compete right now and make the finals and really give LeBron that chance. They didn't do that. So already when you're getting into this parsing of like, oh, I wish they'd rather have Lopez or Ellington, I think Lakers fans just need to take the L on this one and say, admit, like, yes, like their best case scenario dropped, very quickly after they couldn't get Paul George and Kawhi Leonard was traded elsewhere. So to me, there's a lot of head scratching and moves where I think have a lot of, dynamite potential in terms of the veterans they're bringing in here and what their track record is in terms of contributing to winning. Yeah. I'm a skeptic on Beasley. I'm a skeptic on Lance. I'm a skeptic on Rondo. Basically, I'm definitely a skeptic on JaVale as well. That doesn't mean they're going to be completely worthless moves, but I just don't think they're going to accomplish a ton. But when you're looking forward, to next summer, are you going to be able to get meaningful upgrades? And how many holes do you have in this lineup, aside from the young guys? Those are still unanswered questions. And so I don't think we need to be parsing their one-year contract moves that much. The bigger point is they struck out an awful lot this summer in places we didn't expect them to strike out.
Yeah, I was thinking about this last night because this question came in. And the best way I can explain the Lakers summer is like, sometimes when you're at a wedding and someone will be overserved and just kind of a little drunker than everybody else. And they'll do something that's kind of crazy, and you look at them and you're like, oh, that's hilarious. That person's partying. He's having a good time. And then you check back in like 45 minutes and they're still kind of just like pushing the envelope and everyone's getting a little bit uncomfortable. And you look around and you're like, oh, this is getting kind of awkward. And then you check back like 2.5 hours later and they're just like way drunker than everybody. And it's just kind of depressing. Like, that's how I feel the Lakers free agency has unfolded since signing LeBron. Like, it was kind of a zany thing when you saw they were bringing in Lance and then they bring in JaVale and you're like, okay. And then the Rondo thing and the Beasley thing. I think their long-term play, it's going to take a while to sort of know whether this was the right move or not. But short-term, this is just so weird. And I understand that they're not going to play big minutes next season, but they're all veterans who are probably going in there expecting to get a decent amount of playing time, and it just doesn't
matter. They're definitely
going to
play. I think those guys are all going to play, and that's the thing. And I think the only real positive from this collection of moves in terms of the veterans I can see is that if they do lose games, especially early on in the season, there will always be distractions to sort of keep people occupied. You know, like, there's
and
always going to be a fall guy.
That might be why they're doing it, right? Like, these might be, like, legit fall guys that they're bringing in.
I think if you can't win the Larry O'Brien Trophy, you might as well win the internet. I think that's their mentality.
Yeah.
Like, I think they're just trying to, like, if we can't be victorious, let's be viral. I think that's sort of their game plan.
The one thing we know is that none of these are coincidences. Like, it would be one thing. Maybe JaVale is an outlier, and then you bring in 4 or 5 other guys who are solid additions. But when you sign Lance and JaVale and Rondo and Beasley, that's a strategy. There was an internal memo there to go in and bring in the most unreliable guys in the league. So whatever it was, whatever the motivation was driving that, we don't really know. But there was clearly sort of a unified strategy.
I can think of one, which is if LeBron can turn them into useful parts, that really furthers his MVP
narrative, doesn't it? Yeah, I guess.
I mean, like, he saved Beasley's career. He saved Lance's career. He saved JaVale's career. He saved Rondo's career. Wow, what a miracle worker. Everyone thought these guys were bums. He turned them into a team. They won, you know, 48 games or 50 games, and now LeBron has to be rewarded with the MVP. I could see that as being, you know, one potential motivating factor. It's sort of like the J.R. Smith experience in Cleveland before last year, where LeBron was sort of seen as like the adopted father of J.R. Smith's career and, like, you know, massaging him into a worthwhile player, just like times by 4 at every single position. Like, LeBron and the Misfits, right? That really sets up pretty nicely for, you know, an MVP track.
All right. Well, there's been enough Lakers talk for July 2018. So with that, 3 quick questions at the end. The first is from Kimberly, which is, it's more of a comment. And she says, first time emailer, long time listener. My first podcast was the July 4th Kevin Durant pod 2 years ago. And I have never looked back after listening to hours of endless, unbearable Ben-splaining, slander of Sharp's flexibility of thinking and unbearable Durant takes. DeMar DeRozan's arrival to the monastery brings me the deepest, pettiest of joys. And first of all, I want to thank Kimberly for being on Team Sharp. And I also want to thank her for introducing us to the term Ben-splaining, which I think is going to be a theme of next season. I'm going to try to keep that alive.
Yeah, I mean, if you were as clever and as witty as Kimberly is, we'd be on to something. Let me say that. No, I'm kidding. She owned me. What am I supposed to do? I have to take my loss here. She wins.
Yeah.
Great email. And the DeMar, everyone's really worried about my mental health here for the DeMar to San Antonio thing. And I think people are kind of confusing how much I revere the Spurs organization versus how much I revere, like, the Duncan Spurs. And it's just a totally different group. I think, looking back, the Kawhi trade officially sealed the end of all of those hopes and all of that legacy talk. I mean, it's just kind of kapoof, and this new version is going to be much different, much less entertaining. much less kind of competitive in terms of, you know, the standard where they're going to be, you know, playing on a night-to-night basis. And, you know, from that standpoint, it's very easy to disengage with what they're doing down there. I haven't found it, you know, very difficult transition at all.
No, let's be real. You are 100% defecting to Jazz Nation next season and will become a full-time member of the Tabernacle in Salt Lake City. That's the game plan here.
Not a bad idea at all, Andrew. I am looking for a fallback option. There are very many Spurs-like qualities to what the Jazz are trying to do out there. And of course, I love their shameless pandering to the outdoor enthusiast in me. So I'll keep them on my radar. But I'm not going to necessarily, you know, announce my allegiances beforehand. I have to sort of let these guys, you know, play for the right to have my heart. And,
well,
and I'll
yeah.
jump in when I see fit.
You don't ever announce your allegiances. That's for the listeners. They can listen closely to figure out who deep down you absolutely hate and who you love. So look forward to that next season also. But continuing
and also,
on,
hey, Kimberly, I hope you enjoy Kevin Durant's third ring and third finals MVP next year. I hope you take that one. You know, I'll lose right now in the short term, but I'm going to win the war eventually, just like I have with Sharp for the last 2 years.
Good for you. Good for you. Will says, hey, guys, I have never written in before, but I have to say this. Andrew, it's pronounced Nemanja Bjelica. It's part of your job to get players' names right. I have to admit, I got quite annoyed listening to your floundering in the last podcast. Please try harder. And honestly, I don't have a defense on this point either, because I was putting a lot of oomph into my Bjelica pronunciation on the last podcast, and I can understand why, if you know how it's correctly pronounced, that would be particularly obnoxious. We did have a couple people writing in saying that, aren't you supposed to be, some variation of, aren't you supposed to be an NBA journalist? And I will only
Ouch.
Say, like, there are 500 players in the NBA, and I can give you a decent amount of information on about 450 of them. I knew exactly who Nemanja Bjelica was, but when we were recording the podcast last week, I put that question in about 15 minutes before we went on, and all I knew is that his name is not pronounced phonetically. It's spelled Bjelica, and I knew it wasn't pronounced that way. I knew there was an Itza in there somewhere. I just forgot that there was a Bia. So that's my bad, but Bjelica is a tougher name to pronounce than most.
Well, look, first of all, I love Will saying, please try harder. What a mantra. I think we should try to adopt that one for this podcast. Second of all, I was also very annoyed at your Bjelica talk.
I know you were. You
pronunciation. But look, Andrew, the pronunciation was the lesser issue. Yes, you butchered it like 7 or 8 times, but you also like quadruple back to bring him up into the conversation when he's, you know, you mentioned there's 500 NBA players. He's what, like 375th in terms of importance? And you kept trying to tell me about how important it was, this whole Philadelphia thing. And he signed with someone else, or at least I think he agreed to. And did anyone care? No. I mean,
no.
Fantastic news. And so, thank you. So, what I'm saying is this.
Mike Muscala, everything's fine. Whatever. That was just a waste of 5 minutes there.
Thank you. So if you can't pronounce the name, that's one thing. But if you can't pronounce the name of a player who's not important, that's what aggravates me, Andrew. So we're going to call a secession of Bjelica references. It's not going to happen for at least 12 months unless he's in the NBA Finals. We are not going to mention him.
All right.
That's a promise.
Well, there you go.
And in that way, everyone will be off your back. You know, you can't mispronounce a name that you don't say.
I did deserve it. The idea that every NBA journalist should pronounce every NBA name perfectly is a little bit of a stretch, but I deserve the heat on that one, and mostly because I was being so obnoxious about pronouncing it wrong. Anyways, continuing on with our final question from Daniel, and this is from a month or two back, but I had saved it. What would it take for either of you to get a tattoo of an NBA player? For instance, if LeBron leaves the Cavs next year and Rodney Hood averages an incredible 15-3-2 and leads the Cavs to a miraculous 44-win seventh seed, maybe Sharp could get a biceps tat of Hood taking an open step-back mid-range. Or if KD wins a unanimous MVP next season, Ben gets a tat of KD's infamous shot over LeBron last year, but he's wearing his Portland draft workout jersey from when Ben said the Blazers had to draft him. My initial takeaway from this is that this could get very dangerous, and it's good that neither one of us are doing NBA tattoos, because like, we have these little 3-month inside jokes on the podcast that could then become like permanent if tattoos were entering the mix, because I could
lifelong regrets.
Had Rodney Hood come in to the finals in like game 4 and changed that series, and the Cavs had somehow won and Rodney Hood was like named finals MVP, it's not entirely impossible that I would have gotten a Rodney Hood tattoo. And that's kind of terrifying to think about, because I haven't thought about Rodney Hood in like 6 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, no tattoos for me. The only tattoos I have are vegan, all-natural tattoos, which are also known as scars. I collect scars, not tattoos. There's no way I would ever, you know, put ink on my body, especially to commemorate a basketball moment. No,
live
that being
from the
said,
rocking chair here.
Yeah, no, that being said, I mean, if anyone was going to get us to put a tattoo on our bodies, it would be Giannis, right? I mean, if Giannis,
sure,
like, led the Bucks to a title.
This is why it's dangerous. A Giannis ink tattoo isn't completely crazy.
If he led the Bucks to a title, there's a chance we get full body back tattoos of the Greek flag, even though I've never been there. I'm not sure if you've been there, but that's not out of the question. Or, like, if he ever dunked from the 3-point line, you know, which also distinct possibility when Giannis hits the open court, like an image of that, sort of like that famous Jordan dunk contest image. I mean, that would look pretty awesome, like across the shoulders. But at the same time, I don't really have the physique to make tattoos look good. So I'm going to leave that to the guys on Muscle Beach.
That's a good point.
And the
yeah.
NBA players. I think I'm just going to let them have that lane.
We're both past 30, so our tattoo prime has kind of come and gone. But the Giannis point is a good one. Look, I want to take this opportunity. You generally plug the ratings and the reviews at this point. If anyone from Nike has listened 85 minutes into the podcast, send us the new
again,
Giannis
Andrew.
Shoes. Please send us the new Giannis shoes. I want a prototype. That's where we'll leave it, okay? And we'll be back next week.
Look, Kimberly, you just came at me so hard in the emails. Just remember that I'm out here promoting the Open Floor brand. I'm not begging. Andrew comes on here at least twice a month just begging for sneakers.
Look,
it's absolutely shameless.
If
all right,
we're
that's a Ben-splaining
going
for you, Andrew.
Through August, I am going to be out here whoring myself out looking for free shit. Okay? That's going to be my incentive to keep this going in the off season.
Oh boy. Well, sorry, Elizabeth, for that one. You're hearing what he's saying about himself. Don't ever allow your future to be clouded in such unnecessary, motivations. Andrew, the listeners can go to Apple Podcasts, search Open Floor. It's two words. Scroll down. It says rate and review. Tap 5 stars. Keep the momentum going here during the off season. Also, keep the questions coming. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. Go ahead and roast us. You know, it's the off season. We're sure to get those ones in, especially if Andrew's, you know, picking the questions, people roasting me left and right. I see how it is. Andrew, until next week, after USA Basketball, comes together, convenes in Las Vegas, and I will be there. I will talk to you.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.